Well, I was born in the city of Winnipeg on December the 3rd, 1920, in Grace Hospital. I'm the son of, the oldest son of George William Ballingall, who at the time of my enlistment was retired from the T. Eaton Company, where he had formerly been a manager of a department in the mail order. My mother's name is Mary Elizabeth Ballingall. I have two brothers who both served in the forces and one sister. I was educated in Winnipeg schools, subsequently with a first-year university entrance, at the time of my enlistment with the Winnipeg Grenadiers. I was in the militia of the Grenadiers and actually mobilized prior to the actual declaration of war by Canada.
Before the war broke out, had you left school or were you employed?
I had left school.
Where were you employed?
At that particular time, I was working, when war broke out, I was working with T.W. Kilshaw Auctioneers in the Canada Building. I was driving a truck and also worked part-time doing auction duties and clerking and things like this.
And you said you were already enlisted in the military before?
Yes, I was in the NPAM, the Non-Permanent Active Militia, with the Winnipeg Grenadiers at the outbreak of war. I had been previously with the Cadet Corps, the Royal Canadian Army Service Corps Cadets, and subsequently with the Royal Canadian Corps of Signals, and then to the Winnipeg Grenadiers, where I'd probably been in them for about 2 years, I guess, before mobilization.
When the Grenadiers went to Jamaica, they went in 1940, I believe.
That's correct.
What can you recall about the trip going to Jamaica? If you went by train, or plane, boat?
No, I went by boat. By train, of course, to Halifax or Montreal. I can't remember where we embarked. Halifax. I think it was Halifax, yeah. And I can't remember the name of the boat. We went to the West Indies, stopping at Bermuda, where one company was left in Bermuda. And I went on to Kingston, Jamaica. And during that period of time there, I was acting regimental quartermaster sergeant for the regiment when we went to Jamaica, and I set up all the accounts with the various people, the food accounts, the meat accounts with the West India Coal Storage Company, and the vegetables, potatoes, and so on and so forth, even to the breweries, getting the beer and the rum and so on and so forth into the messes. That was my primary task at that time.
Type of training, if any, was done down in Jamaica?
Well, very intensive training in Kingston, up our camp, and also at the Hill Station, Newcastle, and also at a summer camp known as Montpelier, which was situated by Montego Bay. Very intensive ground training, basic training, arms, map using, a certain amount of tactics. Exercises took place at Montpelier and at the Hill Station. Also, companies were used for such things as ship's guard inspection, and also we had an internment camp, which we were responsible for supplying quarter guards, etc. for.
And when did you come back to Winnipeg?
I guess it would be October 1941.
Okay. And going to Hong Kong. I left in...
Well, November, I guess it was, or late October. Might have been September, late September when we got back, and late October. We weren't home very long anyway before we went to...
What were your feelings when you were put on a train heading west and nobody was told where they were going?
Oh, there were many mixed feelings as to where we were going. Nobody actually knew, the life in the West Indies had been pretty good, and the general opinion that was floating around was that we were going to some exotic Far East country, you know, and things that would be pretty much the same as we had it in Jamaica. I think this was the primary feeling. Nobody thought that we were going to be involved in a war as soon as we were, I'm certain of that, in the Far East.
How long was the trip to Vancouver on the train?
Well, I think probably two nights on the train and three days, I guess, something like that.
What happened when you arrived in Vancouver?
Well, we immediately went aboard ship. I don't think we were on a, as I recall, I don't think we were on a, stationed in any quarters in Vancouver on outgoing. We went right aboard a ship. I think it was the, if I remember correctly, it was the Awatea, New Zealand ship, or Australian ship, Australian New Zealand lines, I think it was.
And did you leave right away? Same day?
No. We were aboard the ship for a night or two before we actually sailed, as I recall.
Okay. And do you recall anything of interest that would have happened or that did happen on the ship between Vancouver and Hong Kong?
Not particularly, other than the food was lousy. I guess from everybody. Australia, and there was tripe, of course, and it was mutton, and it was constituted primarily of the diet over there. It was a pretty lousy diet, but of course there were all sorts of things to compensate for it, that you could purchase yourself, such as chocolate bars and beer and whiskey, etc., if you were drinking that. So the food really wasn't that important at that particular time.
Was any announcement made on the boat before you arrived in Hong Kong as to where your destination would be?
To tell you the truth, I don't remember. I don't think so. I think we just sort of, I don't think there was a formal announcement made. I think it just sort of came by the grapevine just prior to us actually reaching Hong Kong. Of course, we knew where we were going, somewhere in that direction, because we stopped in Honolulu on the way down in Hawaii, and, you know, knew what general direction we were going in. There was some talk, too, I think, about the fact that we were going to be in the Philippines before we got to Hong Kong. But I'm sure there wasn't a formal announcement made.
Your arrival in Hong Kong, can you give some details on this, what happened as soon as you got there, and then training and the garrison duty, things like this?
Well, we were disembarked, and I remember we marched through the streets of Kowloon, and went to the camp where we were stationed on the Sham Shui Po, and took up our quarters there. It was quite a different type of garrison, of course, than we had in the West Indies. And but we had no reason at that time to believe that, you know, that it wasn't going to be a pretty good station either. And our training resumed somewhat on the basis, on a similar basis that we had been doing in the West Indies, a lot more basic training because we had over a half to three quarters of a battalion of new men. And subsequently they had to have basic training. And of course we finally, after two or three days, were given some leave and able to get out and view the sights of Hong Kong, which were quite novel to us at that time.
The actual battle itself, where were you when the bombing started? What was your reaction to it?
Where was I? We were stationed in Hong Kong. We were on the island at the time that the bombing actually started.
Do you recall the place? Was it a certain mountain or?
Yeah, we were located adjacent to Bennett's Hill, and consequently moved up to Wan Chai Gap, where we were in support of A Company. I was at that time with the 3-inch mortar platoon, and we had moved up to support A Company in Wan Chai Gap, and eventually we retreated back to Bennett's Hill, where we set up a mortar position on top of the hill, which Sergeant Webster and myself jointly commanded at that time with a Corporal Agerback. And subsequently Sergeant Webster was killed on the top of the hill. And we were working in conjunction with a post below the hill, which was manned by British forces. And the officer in charge of us at the particular time was Lieutenant Pendergast from Winnipeg, or Captain Pendergast, I guess he was a captain then.
And how long did the fighting last? Was it a week or 2 weeks? Did you see action all the time?
Well, we were in action till, I guess the day before Christmas, when we were, we had moved back then to off the hill to the Aberdeen Reservoir, and then we were at a naval barracks at Aberdeen, and moving back and forth between those two positions, we'd hooked up with other elements of the time, one of the C Company of our battalion, and with some naval volunteers and some Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps who had joined us at that time, and we were moving back and forth between Aberdeen and Pock Fulham until Christmas morning. Until Christmas morning, when we found out that there had been a capitulation. Subsequently, we moved in, I guess, to North Point Camp over a period of the next 2 or 3 or 4 days or something like that. When we were actually listed and so on and so forth, taken into the camp, whatever administration it was, I don't remember.
How did you find out about the capitulation?
Well, our officers told us and came down and told us that there had been a capitulation, that we were defeated. Of course, we knew we were going to be anyway because we had no arms. We only had whatever small arms and personal sidearms we had with us, and no ammunition. The water supply had been cut off, so there was no way for us. I mean, it was a hopeless. We had no artillery support, no air support, no naval support. We were just boxed in. I mean, it was a hopeless situation as far as defense was concerned.
And you said you ended up in North Point Camp. Now, what was daily life like here? As to food, if there was any sickness at this time?
Well, in North Point, we weren't very long in North Point. I guess it was only a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. This was on the island to a month, possibly. If I don't think it was that long, though. I think maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And then we were moved to Champs-Chapeau, back to Champs-Chapeau. And the immediate routine, as I recall it then, was that we were up in the morning, went out to work on the Kitek Airport site, and back in the evening, and that was it, sort of thing. That was initially in Champs-Chapeau. Then I guess subsequently, after about 3 or 4 months, they were looking for some. Our situation had deteriorated somewhat by at the end of 3 or 4 months, physically primarily, and to some degree mentally. And at that particular time, they were looking for some volunteers to work in our makeshift hospital, which is as we had made do with a certain number of huts. And I volunteered for work in this hospital, and eventually became the ward master of the hospital, trained under our own doctors and British doctors. And Portuguese doctors and Indian doctors, and who were absolutely fantastic. And I believe this was one of the major advantages as far as my own physical or mental condition, not physical, but my own mental condition, was the fact that I gave myself something to do. And of a different nature than just the average POW was doing. And subsequently, also, I learned to speak Japanese through a Portuguese boy that was with the Hong Kong Volunteer Corps, a lad by the name of Robert Pereira. And as a result of my position in the hospital and my knowledge of the language, which I adopted quite quickly, I went into a trading sort of a service for medicines and whatever we could get in exchange for cigarettes and everything, which were supplied by the doctors. And I became sort of known as the training service for the doctors in the hospital.
What was the food like at this time?
Well, our diet was rice, boiled rice, and some green vegetables and water, boiled in the water, and so it's a type of a soup and that, you know. This was primarily the diet right through our whole internment, both in Champs-Chapeau, in the New Territories, and subsequently those of us that moved to Japan likewise had a similar diet.
Were you on the first draft to Japan?
No. I was on either the second or the third draft. I guess it would be the second. I went to Oyama, number 3.
Oyama 3. Do you recall anything about the trip to Japan?
Oh yeah, that was a most horrible experience. We were in like bloody rats in a dungeon in a hole, and with no lavatory facilities or anything like this, and we're just fortunate that we were allowed to clean ourselves up and move out every once in a while on the trip over, or as it wonder who the hell we all didn't die from one thing or another. As a result of the impact into that hold, the breathing and everything was absolutely almost impossible. A most discomforting trip.
What happened on your arrival in
Japan? Well, we moved to Oyama camp. As I say, we were, I forget, in Nagasaki, I guess, where we landed. And we were taken and put on a train and taken to this camp where we were eventually set up in Oyama.
What was the daily life like here?
Well, it varied. I became the hanchou of a ham. This is like a hut, and I was put in charge of one of the huts, which was the largest group of men in our camp, 110 men. We worked in shifts at the moving coal from one pile to another. It was an absolute useless task just for something to do. But then we moved. The coal was, of course, eventually loaded onto cars which were pulled up to a manufacturing plant, where they were crushing rock. Coal was feeding the furnaces, and the rock was crushed, and they were making a flux used in hardening steel and everything. And also the ore came from a mine adjacent to us, which other parts of our men worked on. And I was able to continue my medical work in the field, not in the hospital in Oyama, but in the field. I was given the priority to work with these people. Excuse me. Very bad. Extremely high degree of dysentery. We had a very strong degree of minor mental unbalance. Would be the simplest way of putting it, without trying to be technical. The strain had more than taken its toll of a big majority of the men. And then we were working under some handicaps with the particular Japanese that we had in charge of our camp. We're a bunch of real screwballs, and this created some more difficulties, such things as stoppage of our cigarette ration and so on and so forth. And we were at loggerheads with a couple of our own leaders who were in our particular camp, that were in cahoots with the Japanese, which created another problem for us.
Was the Japanese treatment of the Canadian prisoners of war, was it good or...
Well, no, we had certainly our fair share of brutality in many ways, shapes, and forms. But one thing I can tell you is that for some reason or other, the Canadians were treated far better than any other prisoners of war, that is, the Americans or the British. The Japanese, for some reason, had a very high regard and respect for the Canadians, even though they were prisoners of war. This didn't stop us from getting, as I say, our fair share of the brutality. It didn't make any difference as far as the food or anything else that was concerned, but they did show much more respect for the Canadians than the other nationalities, and don't ask me why, I don't know.
What about the Japanese treatment of their own men?
Well, they were... That's an extremely good question, because they were brutal and to a degree of their own military personnel. To the best of my knowledge, they disciplined the man right on the spot. Rather than give him 7 days confined to barracks or anything like this, they would beat him up within an inch of his buddy's life with his own rifle and everything right on the spot if he was caught doing something wrong or anything. So they were very brutal. And another thing about regarding our treatment of our own, we had many civilians. These were Japanese soldiers who had served in different theaters of war, had been wounded for one reason or other, discharged from the Japanese army and pressed into service as civilian guards in prisoner of war camps. And many of these people were, of course, inclined to be more brutal in their treatment of the prisoner because of the fact that they had suffered wounds and so on and so forth from British American or Canadian, as it might have been during the war.
What type of job did you do in the mine? Did you have a certain duty, or because you were in charge of a group of men, you didn't have to work?
Oh, no. Everybody worked, hand jobs and everything, regardless. I mean, there were a number, you know, I mean, there were like in our camp in Oyama, there were 11 hands, so there were 11 hand shells, and they all did different jobs, but they were responsible for the count of their men and so on and so forth. But my particular job, I wasn't in the mine. Very seldom was I in the mine. I worked between the factory and the coal yards, and I worked, as I say, I was in charge of the medical and seeing that, you know, working in conjunction, seeing the men were working. I moved coal with a shovel, operated the winch, and subsequently was which was a huge lark at the particular time, although it nearly cost me three fingers, I was able to sabotage the winch and consequently delay the work for about 3 days and made it look like an accident. And of course it was much more authentic and looked like an accident rather than a case of sabotage, because I had three fingers hanging off. And subsequently, nobody, the Japanese guards and everything at the time, didn't think that it would have been done on purpose.
Was there any medicine at all, like to treat the sick men?
Yes, there was a very minor... very high degree of rationing as far as medicine was concerned, both in China and in Japan. But there were a small degree of medicine, but not enough, for example, to control dysentery or anything like that. But there were certain sulfa not available to control minor degrees of illness, a certain amount of aspirin to try and keep fever down and this sort of thing. But as I say, it was as far as anything for major surgery or anything like this was concerned, there was no assistance in that direction. The Japanese doctors worked in conjunction with the British doctors, in our case in Japan. Whereas in China, the Allied doctors worked completely alone. They had very little liaison with Japanese doctors. But there was a permanent Japanese doctor in the camp in Japan, as well as a British doctor, and they sort of worked in conjunction together.
How long were you at Oyama camp?
About 2 years.
You were there right till the end of the war, were you?
Yes.
What was it like in the camp near the end of the war? Did the men know that the end was near? Or?
Well, there were always rumors, and then sort of you'd peck, try to perk up, but we had no knowledge of what was actually going on at all. The first knowledge we had that something drastic had been a drastic change was while we were at work, and all of a sudden we noticed a great change in the guards, that they had moved away and everything, and there were tears and they were crying in certain respects and everything, and we knew then that something was wrong. But it was a full day or so later before we knew that the war had actually come to an end.
How did you finally find out? Did they tell you, or?
Yes, they told us. They told our officers, who in turn passed the information on to us. And then there were immediately steps taken to mark the roofs of the camp so that they could be identified by American aircraft.
What happened to the Japanese at the as soon as we found out that the war was over? Did they disappear?
No, they remained in charge of the camp until the and worked in conjunction with our officers. Of course, things changed. The discipline, of course, was they didn't interfere with us, but they were still in charge of the camp until the American officers who relieved the garrison put in an appearance. But subsequently, we were food was dropped to us by parachute by American aircraft, and this was in our charge, not in charge of the Japanese, and as far as the distribution and everything was concerned.
Did the Americans drop quite a bit of supplies?
Yes, they did. They, within a week, might have been even earlier, 3-4 days. I just can't recall now, but they were dropping medical supplies and food, canned goods, and well, pretty well everything that you can think of. One of the most amusing things of just at that particular time in conjunction with the air drops was some P-51s put in an appearance, and they bombed the camp with sugar in women's panties and brassieres, etc., which was done as a moral boost by these Air Force, American Air Force pilots. And it created a lot of fun for those of us that were prisoners in the camp, and it scared the hell out of the Japs with just a little interesting sideline. One of the things, of course, was the control of the food. Because of the high, the food that was dropped was very high in calories and proteins, etc., and it immediately had its effect on many of us whose stomachs and bowels and everything were in a very, very degraded condition. And subsequently, in many cases, it created a more serious illness than by too much intake at once. In fact, actually did cause the loss of a few lives as a result of that.
What happened, how did you finally leave Oyama Camp, and where were you taken?
Oh, we were, Americans came to the camp, and they took over the garrison. They were responsible for boarding us on the trains. And they took us to Yokohama, and subsequently there we were put on the docks and sprayed like animals with DDT and everything, which of course was natural. And then we were put aboard a hospital ship for 24 hours, where we were given a considerable medical examination and tagged for dispatch to an American vessel in the harbor, and subsequent onward dispatches by various ways to Canada.
Can you tell me something about your trip home, if there was any stops along the way and what happened at each stop?
Well, I had a most interesting trip home. First of all, it happened that I was segregated. I went aboard the battleship USS Indiana, and subsequently, the only time I ever walked in my sleep in my life, the first night aboard that, and I got up evidently in my sleep and walked through an open hatch and fell a deck, which is about 25, 30 feet or something like that, on an open hatchway, and ended up in the sick bay with badly bruised, with fortunately nothing, actually, and sprains, but nothing broken. But eventually it came time that I was to be dispatched. I got up on my own and got to the deck to remove myself, and the officers immediately sent me back to the damn sick bay, and they did put me up, but they had brought me back up on a stretcher, this journey I had just made. But already we were back in the routine of the technicalities of the service. I was on an airplane on a packet of 10, and I, as it happened, I was the only Canadian on this aircraft. Because of my name, I guess, being a B, and the surname I had been put, I was the first one that got on this aircraft out of this particular group. We're in a packet of 10 flying to Guam. And we came into a huge tropical storm, and the other 9 planes were grounded somewhere along the line that were behind us in the packet. And we were forced to go on because we were past the point of no return. Subsequently, we spent 4.5 hours over the island of Guam, ditching gasoline and to make a forced landing. And it was a great experience, this particular aircraft, and flying up over the sheer mountain walls and this driving rain like you've never seen in your life. And finally we were landed on an emergency field in mud, even though there were 7 paved airstrips on the island of Guam. We were forced to land in this type of a landing field. And it was amazing, the experience just in here, regardless, this is not relative to prisoner of war, but the confidence that was shown by the crew and also by ourselves when the pilot of the aircraft came back after he landed, and they all went up and patted him on the back, nice going, skipper. And to look at the lad, he was couldn't have been any more than 21 years of age, and he looked as if he had just stepped out of the rain, the driving rain. He was just soaked from head to foot himself. So he'd had a tremendous battle in bringing this aircraft down, with some 60 passengers aboard, I might say, too. Then subsequently, I stayed in Guam in a U.S. Fleet Hospital, 103, for a period of close to a month. Then I went from Guam to Honolulu to Hawaii Heights Hospital, where I was for another 2 weeks, and then subsequently to San Francisco and to Fort McDowell, which is an island that's situated next to Alcatraz, and we're there for 3 or 4 days, and then subsequently to Vancouver and back to Winnipeg. But another interesting trip on the way home was boarded an aircraft again in Honolulu. The flight from Guam to Honolulu was incidental, except that, again, I had the... All of my way home, I was the only Canadian on board this aircraft, and I was with the late General Wainwright, and the prisoners who were taken at Wake Island, which were all American civil engineers and everything, they were civilian prisoners. We got to Hawaii, as I say, and after leaving Hawaii Heights Hospital, we boarded a seaplane and took off from Honolulu and had to make a forced landing with a fire in an engine. And subsequently, it was beginning to look like aircraft were going to be our downfall before we ever got back home. Evidently, subsequently, we were taken from the seaplane and put onto a C-54, which flew us to San Francisco without incident, I might add.
What happened in San Francisco?
Well, I was taken by for a day as the guest of met by Red Cross officials first, normal clearance through Customs and Immigration, which was nothing. They just passed you through immediately. And of course, everywhere, one of the first things you ever did now was they made sure if you wanted something to eat or had a cup of coffee or anything like this. And then an American petty officer in the Navy took charge of me personally and showed me around the town and quartered me for the evening and then put me on the boat, which incidentally was the government boat, to Alcatraz, and took us to Fort McDowell, where at this particular time I was now, in my particular case, turned back to under the control of the Canadian Army. Previously, I'd been attached for all purposes to the American Navy on my return home, as were many of us.
What was the trip like from San Francisco to... Did you go to Vancouver?
Went to Vancouver. Most enjoyable. It was a real nice trip. We were on a regular passenger train and everything. And by a strange coincidence, I met my first contact from home on this train, where I met a young lady who was serving with the CWAC and had been a lifelong friend of mine. Subsequently, this was quite a warm reunion and meeting. This girl, Helen Smale, was her name. And subsequently, she too, of course, met the other boys that we were traveling together. And when we got to Vancouver, she was able to arrange many things to make us feel more at home immediately and everything, and subsequently also in Victoria.
What happened in Vancouver, Victoria? Did you enter hospital again?
Or? No. We were just in barracks and clothed and got money, made contacts with our families and everything, of course, and just pending. We were interviewed by psychiatrists and everything at this particular point and given through a medical examination and subsequently returned home.
What was the arrival in Winnipeg like?
Well, warm and touching, and I had stopped some friends immediately previous to my employment, my last employment with the Army. I had been working on a railroad, as likewise on the running trades, and had met people across the country, and I was met by people in Saskatoon, where I spent 2 days before coming home. And when I got home, it was warm and touching. We were, as I say, we were arriving individually. We weren't a group, so it was a regular. Our family were there, and my brothers and my sister, mom and dad, and many other relatives, and a warm welcome and took home.
Were there many Canadians on the train, or were they in very small groups, or was there a large group?
Well, I think initially some of the groups got some of them that were not detained too long in hospital sort of came back in larger groups. But I came home individually, or with one or two, I can't even recall, that were on the train with me.
And do you recall what date you arrived in Winnipeg?
No, I don't. I couldn't tell you to save my life.
Did you enter a hospital here again?
I went on to Toronto. And I was in Shirley Park Military Hospital for treatment for some 3-4 months or more, subsequently for amoebic dysentery and several other things, that were deteriorations of the body and the eyes, etc. And subsequently, after discharge, spent some time in Malton Convalescent Hospital after Shirley Park, and then have spent some time in Deer Lodge on two or three occasions, but I've been, on the whole, very fortunate as far as my health is concerned, touch wood.
And where are you employed now, and what position?
I'm doing public relations work now with the Manitoba Odd Fellows of the Independent Order of Odd Fellows. Public relations and advertising have been my primary function over the last 20 some odd years. I had difficulty in finding employment immediately following the war due to state of nerves and so on and so forth, and bad health. And subsequently was told by my doctor to get an outside job. I did. I got a job on a truck and eventually became a sales manager for a soft drink company, which did a lot to build me up both physically and mentally. Subsequently, I went into the life insurance business for some 7 years and then spent the balance of my career in the advertising and public relations field. Other than for a break some 2 years ago, when my first experience with a mild mental breakdown as a result of Hong Kong experiences, which were proven to me by psychological psychiatrists, I had to take pretty well a whole year off and not do anything. Relax and still feel some of these pressures every once in a while, and it's amazing. You think you don't have them, you think that you're one that has escaped them, but it is there, and these people certainly know how to find out and convince you of what has caused the difficulty. You may think you've escaped scot-free, but no one, of course, has.
Were there any funny tricks men used to find each other, or any other interesting personal experiences that happened during the war?
Oh, there are, of course, many personal experiences that happened during the war. The spirit of camaraderie that existed between us as fellow prisoners, I think, is one of the highest in the world. Every one of us sort of had a degree of beriberi, and it came in various stages known as hot feet and everything like this, and it was fantastic, the cooperation that existed between each of them, where they would try to relieve their mutual distress by squeezing each other's legs and this sort of thing. And, in Champchapeau, in conjunction with the Portuguese and the Indians, and the British and Canadian, I think there was a degree of friendship and camaraderie that sort of knitted them together that was just unbelievable. Really, the how the morale was kept at a considerably high level. There were shows in the days of Championship Poe. These, of course, didn't happen once we got to Japan, but they put together a couple of shows and so forth in La Sagani and a couple of things. These were the cast, the Gypsy, and other Broadway-type shows that they put together with costumes to some extent, so on and so forth, which were most entertaining and did a fantastic job as far as the morale of the camp was concerned. There were many brutalities, of course. One personal experience, I had subsequently lost a great degree of my eyesight due to malnutrition. And prior to leaving Hong Kong, I was on duty at the hospital. And leaving, I had a basin of water. And between the buildings, I had missed seeing the general. I had not seen him, but I was accused of not saluting him. And subsequently, I was called back and in front of all the officers and everything, and was beaten quite brutally by a Japanese officer with a sword, resulting in breakage of my teeth and so on and so forth. And this was stopped by our own Dr. John Crawford, who stepped up and said that was enough and put a stop to it. And subsequently, they took me into the hospital. And it's an amazing thing. Going all through this brutality and being questioned as to why you didn't salute, not a tear escapes you. But subsequently, as soon as it's over and you're put in the hospital, the breakdown was quite funny about how the tears just flowed and flowed. And we had a little joke at that particular time in Hong Kong. If your eyes were really, really bad, you were almost totally blind, we had a caramel type of thing which contained a high degree of vitamin E, which were very strictly rationed. And of course, the joke was that I'd be able to get on caramels now that I had taken this licking and not been able to see the staff officer. That's one of the little humorous things. Oh, there are many, many incidents of some cruel, some funny, some emotionally disturbing, sad things that happen. Many, many things. Just to try and sit back and recount them all. It's really funny. But a lot of, I don't know, it's an experience, and certainly one wouldn't want to live through again. But having lived through it, with a certain degree of health, it's just marvelous to be able to look back on and think it's something that you know, nobody else can ever live for you. And to try and understand the Japanese people to some extent for some of the atrocities that they did commit, the brutality and everything, I don't say it's forgivable in any way, shape, or form. But it's certainly, to some extent, if you understand the Japanese people, have made a point to look into it. As a result of their primary religion at the time, which was known as Shintoism, you can sort of understand why they had this feeling of brutality. And this was, again, augmented by the fact that the food, well, we were extremely rationed as far as rice and everything like this was concerned. As far as the bulk food content that we got, the rice and so on and so forth, we were getting more than the average Japanese soldier. But, of course, his diet was augmented by vitamins in various shapes and forms, pills and so on and so forth, that gave him the strength and the ability to keep himself healthy. But they'd often see us getting this rice, and they'd feel that it would be that we were getting better buddy fed than they were. So it's a very strange series of events that does follow in this respect.
Do you feel the Canadian government has treated you fairly since the war?
Well, no. I think that they are starting to do a better job. It took them a damn long time to create commissions and everything, which finally did prove the fact which we have always stated, that there were many things wrong with us that did not happen to other people. And this, of course, is now a proven fact. It varies in degrees to one another, but I mean, statistics now prove without any doubt that we have the highest mortality rate of any single group of servicemen, and we have the highest casualty rate as far as mental breakdown of any single group of some comment has comments have been made as to the dying breed and so on and so forth. I don't like this because I have this statement myself, because I don't think it's true in that extent, but statistics sort of just bloody well prove the fact that it's happening every day. Our numbers are declining. Our losses, proportionately speaking, are greater as a result of illness since the war than were actually casualties during the war.